Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the show today. I am super excited to introduce somebody who is in my podcasting group, who also has his own podcast that you may be very interested in, called Farmer to Farmer, and it's at farmertofarmerpodcast.com. But he also has a business called The Purple Pitchfork. And so here to share his amazing gardening journey with us today is Chris Blanchard. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks, Jackie. I'm really happy to be here.
Okay, so go ahead and tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. You talk about my gardening experience, and I actually have never had a garden. I've always had farms. You know, I've always been operating on this scale where I was growing for a whole bunch of people, and at least at some level, doing it commercially. So it's kind of funny to be on the Organic Gardener Podcast. But I spent 25 years farming. I farmed all over the country and eventually ended up on my own place in 1999 in Decorah, Iowa. We had Rock Spring Farm, and we grew that business over the course of about 15 years to about 20 acres of vegetables and fresh herbs. We were doing year-round production in our high tunnels, which are, you know, the polyethylene covered greenhouses where we're growing crops in the field. And then a whole lot of perennial herbs and storage crops that we were selling primarily up in the Twin Cities, up in Minneapolis and St. Paul, to the food co-ops, as well as through a CSA. And, you know, went through some personal changes a couple of years ago, and I decided at that point to close things down and really focus full time on sort of what had become a burgeoning consulting business, and ended up ramping that up. And we launched the Farmer to Farmer podcast about a year ago, and just a little less than a year ago, 10 months ago. And that's just been a whole lot of fun. And it's been an adventure.
Excellent. Wow. Well, that's a big, long story there. And amazing. So you just started out as a farmer?
Well, so I got started in gardening. So I actually grew up in the city. I grew up in Seattle. After high school, I went to college, and I actually dropped out of school from the University of Washington, and went and was a ski bum in Aspen for about a year and a half, and somehow managed to finagle my way into this weird little liberal arts school on the California-Nevada state line. It's called Deep Springs College, and it's a liberal arts school with 25 students, but it's located on a working beef and alfalfa ranch, and all the students at the school work on the ranch as part of the education program. And I thought I was going to go and be a cowboy, but the job that they stuck me with was in the garden. And it turned out to be a really good thing, because I learned two really important lessons there. One was that I was afraid of cows, and the other is that I really loved growing vegetables. And for me, you know, I had a friend who died in my senior year of high school, and it really threw me for a loop. I don't have much of a religious background, and I didn't really know what to do with that. You know, that piece of information about, like, oh, people die. You know, things die. Not everything lasts forever. And for me, it's like in the garden, you know, you're stuck in that circle of life all the time. Right? Stuff's living, stuff's dying, stuff's getting eaten, you're killing things, you know, you're bringing things to life, you're putting things on the compost pile. And it was like all of a sudden everything clicked for me. You know, I was like, this is it. I get this. And these are all the answers that I've been traveling around looking for the last couple of years. I found it right here, and, you know, in the garden. And I say garden there. We were raising vegetables for the community. We have about 50 people there. We all ate together every meal, and so all the vegetables during the growing season were coming from the they called it the garden, but it was really, you know, if you're growing 50 people, that's a small farm. We had about 2 acres of vegetables where we were doing that. So, that's where I really got my start. Decided that's what I was going to do for the rest of my life, and started working for other farmers then. So during the term off that I had the following summer, I went and worked for Michael Abelman at Fairview Garden Farms, which is located right right on the inside the suburbs of Santa Barbara. So it's literally surrounded by houses. I think you can smell the McDonald's from the fields. And so I spent about 2 or 3 months there doing farmers markets, growing crops, working at the farm stand. And that really cemented it for me. So then I came out to the University of Wisconsin to finish my horticulture degree out here for the last 2 years of my undergrad. Worked for some more amazing farmers out here in the upper Midwest and ended up just kind of gradually making my way, trying to learn everything that I could and save enough money to where I could get a little grub stake in my own place. That was a long story about how I got started, but that's kind of the nuts and bolts of it.
Okay. So I usually start the show by asking about your very first gardening experience. Is that your very, or like, did you grow up on a garden?
No, I hated
Seattle,
doing yard
but
work.
I mean, Seattle's gorgeous and there's lots of beautiful farm or not, but like people have beautiful lawns and bushes and flowers there.
Oh, it's fantastic. And whenever I go back, you know, and especially sometimes I end up back there like in February or March, and I'm always amazed at how green it is, you know, because now I'm in the upper Midwest. We're actually a little bit south of Seattle here, but we don't have the coastal influence. So, you know, March, everything is just gray and dull and cold and muddy. And you go out to Seattle and it's beautiful and sunny and there's green things everywhere. And it's great. I had no understanding or appreciation of that when I was growing up. I didn't realize how great we had it out there. And I hated gardening. Yeah, I hated doing any kind of yard work. That just was not my thing. And I think for me, the piece that was really missing was that connection with the food. My family didn't have gardens when we were growing up. We had lawns. We had flowers and landscape ornamentals that had to be taken care of and things like that. But I remember having a garden when we were 4 years old. But that's about the extent of the details that I can comment on with that. So yeah, really my first experience was getting thrown into the meat grinder at Deep Springs College.
Crazy. Now, does that college still exist? Can people still go there and work on a ranch while they're going to college?
Yeah, as I like to say, you can go to school and learn to be a cowboy at the same time for free. And so, yeah, that's still there. It's actually was founded in 1917 by a hydroelectric engineer. And we as we like to say, those of us from Deep Springs, we like to say, you know, there were two great social experiments started in 1917, and one of them's still around.
Nice. Okay. 1917. Well, maybe listeners will want to check that out and somebody might want to go there. Do you want to tell us what organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening means to you?
You know, mostly for me, it's doing as little harm as you can do. You know, the funny thing about gardening and in fact farming, the way that it's practiced now, you know, any kind of annual production is a very disruptive and destructive process. You know, it's inherently unsustainable to be doing annual cropping. You have to import nutrients. You're trying to keep things, the right things alive and keep the right things dead so that the right things can flourish. And you want to do that with as little harm as you can possibly manage, you know, to yourself, to the rest of the environment. And, you know, whether that means not putting on excessive fertilizers that end up, excessive soluble fertilizers that end up leaching into the soil, or not putting on toxic pesticides or herbicides. I think it's kind of fundamental.
Okay. Let me just verify for listeners. So when you mean keep the right things alive and the right things dead, you mean like keeping the weeds dead?
You want to keep the weeds dead. Right. You want to keep the bugs, you know, the certain bugs dead, but you want to keep certain bugs alive, you know? And so like, I think about, I mean, part of what organic gardening means to me is organic farming is, you know, you have to, even though there are materials that are technically organic, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the right things to be using. You know, nice. There's a lot of really toxic organic stuff out there. I mean, a good example would be rotenone, which was something that we used in back in the 1990s, was allowed on most organic farms, is currently not allowed under the National Organic Program. You know, the USDA definition of organic doesn't allow rotenone because it's a horrible fish poison. It's really effective at knocking down insects like cucumber beetles, but it also knocks down everything else in the field, you know? And organics doesn't really want a sterile field. That's not the kind of environment we want to be growing our vegetables in. We want an abundance of life, but at the same time, we have to control that life because we've already disrupted the cycle. You know, we've already made a gash in nature's skin, and now we're trying to produce stuff there. And so once we've made that disruption, we have a responsibility to manage that disruption, you know. And this is something I talk about a lot with my farm clients is, you know, management is everything. It's all about deciding what the outcome that you want to have is, you know, and in as a holistic of an approach as possible. You know, it's not just, oh, I want to have a bunch of broccoli. It's, you know, I want to have broccoli that's full of nutrients and doesn't have a bunch of toxic crap on it and is grown in a way that does the least amount of harm to the environment where it's being grown. And once you set those parameters, now you really want to look at the resources and activities that you've got available, and then you have to use those resources and conduct those activities in the ways that help you move towards that defined objective. But all of that comes within this context of we've decided to take an active role in our environment. So we're instantly managing it. We're here, you know, and we're either going to be in control of it or it's going to be in control of us.
Nice. Do you want to tell listeners a little bit about what kind of consulting you do?
Oh, yeah. You know, that'd probably be good, right? So the work I do, and I kind of slid into this accidentally, but I work directly with farmers. And most of my work with growers is around, and it's primarily vegetable farmers, although I've done some work with meat companies and livestock producers, but mostly vegetable farmers. And we're working a lot on kind of the business process side of things. So I do a lot of work around, you know, employee management. I do a lot of work around financial management and sort of thinking about your farm as a business. You know, most people get into farming for lifestyle reasons, you know, quality of life stuff. I mean, like me, right? I got into farming because it answered all my questions about life, the universe, and everything. So that was a great reason to get into farming. But the problem with getting in for that reason is it doesn't do you very good for staying in business, for actually keeping your farm. You know, if you're going to be farming, you got to make money farming. So I help people with that side of things. I also do a lot of work with post-harvest handling so that, you know, what happens when you harvest the produce and how do you keep it as fresh as possible for as long as possible and minimize the handling and labor that goes into it. And along with that, a lot of work on the food safety side of things. So how do you keep food from getting contaminated and minimize the spread of contamination of microbiological, so back, you know, bacterial contamination from one thing to another. So, you know, I'm always geeking out on, you know, when you've got a Listeria outbreak in the cantaloupes, you know, I'm following that like a hawk.
No, so. I don't know any of this. Nobody's talked about any of this on my show. Like what kind of things should people have to like look out for?
Yeah, you know, really as a gardener, there's not much. I mean, you know, you want to wash your hands before you handle your produce. And other than that, you know, you're basically dealing with you know, basic food safety in the kitchen. You know, most food safety issues, you know, most foodborne illnesses in this country come from contamination that actually happens in the kitchen. So, you know, it would be something like, you know, rinsing off your chicken, which you're not supposed to do, by the way, but rinsing your chicken or cutting your chicken with a knife and then using that knife or that sink to cut or wash vegetables in, you know, and then you've got that potential to carry salmonella from the chicken onto your vegetables. Really, as a gardener, there's not a whole lot to be concerned about. I mean, you know, if you've got if there's feces on your produce, don't pick it. You know, that's really what that comes down to, right? You know, so if there's bird poop on the broccoli, you probably don't want to eat that broccoli. Even if you're going to cook it, it's just not worth it.
Okay. All right. But I was just thinking, like, if somebody wanted to try to sell stuff to, like, the farmer's market or take it to a restaurant, are there things that they have to worry? Just wash it and just make sure it doesn't go near your chicken in your kitchen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're going to be selling stuff at the – anytime you're selling – think about how to answer that just a sec.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to get a little bit wonky here because there's a lot going on in the regulatory world around around food safety with the food. People may have heard of the Food Safety Modernization Act and the produce rule, which applies if you're selling over $25,000 worth of produce, there's a chance that you're going to be subject to the produce rule. That's probably not the kind of situation that you're really talking about for most of your listeners right now. Although if you're interested in more information about that, I'd encourage you to check out my website at purplepitchfork.com. And we're going to be getting into more of that food safety stuff as time goes on and as those rules become more apparent about how they're actually going to work. But there is a law that's in this country that says you can't sell adulterated produce. And adulterated produce is defined as, or I should put that differently. Produce that has microbiological contamination. So if it's got organisms on it that can make you sick, that's defined as being adulterated food. So you have to take appropriate steps to keep that food safe. So really, I'd say, you know, if you're selling to restaurants, what you want to do, or at a farmer's market, and you're a small scale grower, you know, make sure you're just paying attention to those common sense things around keeping your food safe. So the most common sense thing of all is washing your hands. You know, wash your hands before you handle the produce, right? You learned that from your mom when you were 3 years old. You wash your hands before you go to dinner. You wash your hands before you cook your meals. You wash your hands before you handle the produce. And that's going to be the biggest one. And then, you know, things like don't pee in the garden, you know, which isn't, you know, stuff like that. I mean, you know, make sure you're managing your manure, any manure that you've got, responsibly. So if you're, you know, if maybe you're cleaning out your backyard chicken coop and you've got some, you got a bunch of manure and you're putting it on the garden, you know, make sure you're not putting it right onto crops that you're going to be harvesting anytime soon. And preferably not on growing crops at all. You know, put it on ground where you don't currently have vegetables, and then maybe plant the vegetables, but have a good interval of time, you know, 90 or 120 days between the time you plant that produce and the time that you, or between the time you apply the manure and the time that you're actually harvesting the vegetables. So it's just, you know, most of the stuff around food safety is advanced common sense.
Okay, cool. Do you want to tell us what inspired you to start using organic techniques? Was that first farm where you were at college like that, or did you learn it somewhere else, or just always been that way?
Well, you know, I've always been an environmentalist. I mean, I was raised in a reasonably ecologically aware house. I mean, my parents weren't hippies, although I think my dad wanted to be one. And, you know, so that's kind of how I came to farming. And the gardens at Deep Springs College were managed organically. The rest of the farm was managed close to organically, but it was, you know, very environmentally conscious operation. But the vegetable program that was all organic from the start. And so I really actually I never learned how to farm with chemicals. It was just, I mean, it's nothing that I've had any experience with. And I did work for the University of Wisconsin at their potato research farm up in Rhinelander, which is way up in northern Wisconsin, in complete potato country. And that was a very heavily chemical operation. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I remember they sent me out to spray the Roundup one time, you know, go spray these weeds with Roundup. So I, you know, I mixed it up and I went out and I sprayed the weeds with Roundup and nothing happened. You know, I mean, I thought that, you know, because herbicides are this big bad thing, right? Shouldn't the weeds, when you hit them with the herbicide, they should have been like curling up and dying. So I went back and sprayed them again. You know, I was like a toxic nightmare out there. But, you know, I've never approached things from that angle. So,
okay.
Yeah, it was just kind of always the default. And, you know, and I mean, and I also have to give a lot of credit. I mean, my mentors at Deep Springs College, Dave and Jane Steidel, who were the farm managers and really were the first people that I worked with hands on in farming, you know, they were very heavily invested in the organic idea. And so it really never occurred to me that it was an option to do anything else.
Nice. It's the way we need to get everybody. Okay. So do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year, wherever you were farming or gardening?
You know, it's kind of funny. This is the first year in 25 years that I haven't grown anything. I I was living in I had a rental house in Decorah, Iowa, and then we moved to Madison in June, and we didn't have time to get a garden started. I guess I did buy some herb plants from my friend Mike Bollinger in Decorah, Iowa, and we brought those and stuck them in herb planters here. I kept them alive for like a month in these little 3-inch pots. We moved into the house here over about a 3-week period, so I brought them when we first came. The squirrels and the rabbits are so bad in town here, it's insane. So I don't know if maybe you've got some suggestions about what to do about that, but I'm kind of concerned about those next year when we get the garden going. But I did keep the herb plants alive, and we got them in some planters up on top of the fence so that the rodents couldn't get into them. And I'd say that was a success. You know, I figure anytime if you're moving and you can manage to grow anything, I can feel pretty happy about that.
Excellent. All right. Well, then how about something you're excited to try next year?
Yeah. You know, next year I'm really excited about gardening. You know, I mean, gardening and farming have a lot in common, but you know, I don't know how to grow just a few of anything, right? I think of things in 100-foot rows. You put in, I mean, if you're going to plant tomatoes, you plant 100 tomato plants. And so I think it's going to be a lot of fun to actually be like, okay, I got these 2 tomato plants and I'm going to really make these things go. You know, and that's going to be a really different approach for me. And I think it's going to leave, I'm hoping that it leaves some room for some experimentation and just some fun, you know, because when you're farming, right, your ass is on the line. When you make a decision about planting something, you know, it's got to work. And so I think having some more room for failure is going to be kind of neat.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of curious about how to grow 100 tomato plants even, or like, was going to like go from gardening. All right. Well, let me tell you a little bit about our situation. So my husband and I have always been really short on water. And so 2 years ago, we dug a well 560 feet deep. And so we're finally at the point where we can start. We're like thinking about, you know, doing a CSA or like, you know, selling stuff for the farmer's market. Like my husband's always wanted to grow enough food for just us so we don't have to buy produce. And like, so right. We're kind of like, so maybe you could give us some advice for like, what should we be thinking about if we want to start trying to produce some stuff for market?
Well, I really think the thing you want to think about if you're going to produce stuff for market is, it's really making sure that you have the resources for every step of the process. So, right. So plants are made of soil, water, air, and sunshine. Okay. And of those things, the sunshine and the air, right, we get as much of those as we need, but we have to make sure that they've got enough nutrients in the soil and that you got enough water. I mean, that's actually one of the biggest things I see with beginning farmers is they don't get enough water on their crops. I mean, vegetables are made out of water. You gotta water them. And this whole idea in most places of an inch a week is actually not fully sufficient. Water's like the cheapest fertilizer you can get. I've talked to growers who've very carefully managed their water to have actually tripled their yields just through irrigation. Okay.
Really?
And so, okay. Yeah. Okay. So if you can imagine that, right. And what's cool is when you triple your yields, now, if you're farming, right, you care how long it's going to take you to pick something, right? If you're gardening, I mean, I don't think anybody wants to be doing things inefficiently, but if you're gardening, like picking beans is part of the outcome, right? That's part of what you're producing is the time that you spend outdoors harvesting the beans. When you're farming, that time that you spend harvesting beans actually becomes an expense. So when you've got triple the yields, now every time you go to grab those beans, you're grabbing 3 times as many beans in every handful, right? And you're moving down the row, you're filling those buckets 3 times as fast, which means you have to walk a lot less far to get each bucket of beans. Mm-hmm. So your efficiency actually goes way up in terms of your harvest. So I think thinking about making sure you have those resources, and it sounds like if you've got that deep well, you probably do have the capacity now to really put some water on those crops. The other things that I see for commercial growers is making sure you have the tools that you need to do the weed control. That's a place where things get harder as you go through the season. It's really easy to put seeds in the ground. right? It's pretty easy to put transplants in the ground. But keeping the weeds under control, that takes a lot more time than putting the seeds in the ground does. So now you've got to keep on top of all those weeds, because there's nothing less fun than picking a 100-foot row of anything out of the weeds. So you want to keep the, you want to make sure that you've got the tools that you need to do that, that are appropriate to the scale that you're operating at. And so, whereas if, you know, if you've got a 400 square foot garden, you could probably get by with a garden hoe. You know, that's going to be sufficient for you. And, but if you've got, if now suddenly you've got a half acre, you know, 20,000 square feet, trying to do that with a standard garden hoe really isn't going to work. And especially, you know, if you're working off farm, you know, you got a day job, so you're coming home and try to manage stuff in the evening, making sure that you've invested in the tools that you need to get that job done right. And then the other one that, and I would imagine that a lot of the people that have self-identified and are listening to the Organic Gardener podcast are folks who are relatively advanced in their growing. So you probably know this already, but that whole concept of succession planting becomes really important in the marketplace. You know, a lot of gardeners will go out on Memorial Day and they put the garden in, and then everything comes in August, and then they're done by Labor Day. You know, and the trick for being a professional grower is to have product over an extended period of time. So doing things like planting your beans every 2 weeks so that you have the first crop of beans, the second crop of beans, third crop of beans, and they're all coming in succession. So you're able to experience that harvest over a much longer period of time. So that would be the other big thing. And I think that's something all gardeners should be doing and being aware of, that idea of succession planting. But it becomes especially important in a commercial setting.
Okay, so I have two questions. So the first one is, what kind of tools do you need to garden a half acre? Like, what are the important tools?
So at a half acre, I'd want to have a rototiller. I mean, that would be and a good rototiller, you know, because that's going to make a big difference for you. It takes a long time to till up a half acre of ground. And so I would want to be looking at, if I was going to get into this commercially, I'd look at getting something like a BCS walking tiller. I have to say, you know, BCS sponsors my podcast, but I've also used BCS tillers since 1991 at Deep Springs College. And I think they're a fantastic tool, but it's really a two-wheeled walking tractor, and it's built like a farm implement. It's not built like a gardener's tool, because at a half acre, you're starting to cross over into that farmland. So I'd want to have a rototiller. I'd want to make sure that I had a good selection of hoes. I'd have a Colonial hoe for every person that was working on the farm. So if it was me and my partner, I'd make sure we had two Colonial hoes.
What's
that's
a
this,
Colonial hoe?
Yeah. So that Colonial hoes, this is the coolest weeding tool ever. It's a very thin bladed hoe. So it's maybe 8 inches long and 1 inch wide, or maybe I should say it's 8 inches wide and 1 inch thick. But then the blade itself is less than a quarter inch thick. So it, and you keep it razor sharp. So it just slices through the soil, and you can hoe very shallowly and very quickly with it. You basically walk down the field with it like a broom. You know, so you're sort of sweeping the weeds out. The trick here is you got to do it when the weeds have either like the day before they germinate or within a few days of when they've germinated. So you're really trying to get them before they put on their true leaves. Once they start to get those true leaves and those stems get a little bit thicker, the Colonial hoe loses its effectiveness. So that would be an important tool. I think another important tool would be a shuffle hoe. And here's where I'm going to say you want to go out and get a good shuffle hoe. I really like the line of tools that Johnny Selected Seeds sells, or Peaceful Valley Farm Supply. They also sell them, and I think they both get them from the same supplier. It's Real, which is a Swiss company. They also known as Glaser, Glaser, and they've got the little two dots over the A. I don't know what that's called, but these are really well built tools. So they're going to be sturdy. They feel good in the hand, but that shuffle hoe with that oscillating blade, the U-shaped blade that goes back and forth, it goes click, 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 click. And so you can do both ways on that. That could be a really great tool for getting ground that's a little bit harder, like your footpaths, or getting or taking care of slightly larger weeds. And at a half acre scale, those two tools would be the only hose that I would feel like I wanted to have. And then I think, you know, having a good bed rake, if you're wanting to get into small scale gardening, the one book that I'd really recommend now is called
the Market Gardener by the Jean Fortier guy.
Yeah, it's The Market Gardener by J.M. Fortier. Yeah. It might be called The Market Farmer, but I think it's The Market Gardener. It's by J.M. Fortier, which is F-O-R-T-I-E-R. So if you search on his name on Amazon, you're going to find it. Mm-hmm. And the he's got this system of 30-inch beds, and then so everything is based around that 30-inch bed. So he's got then the rakes that he would use for shaping that bed and for making sure the top was nice and smooth for planting would be a 30-inch wide rake. And that would be something that I would look at. Because, again, at that half-acre scale, efficiency really begins to matter. You know, you can't spend all day making beds. You need to get out there and get that done in a hurry. And then the other tool that I really like, and this is kind of a JM Fortier standby, is the broad fork, which is like this. It's a 30-inch wide digging fork. So it's got maybe six tines across that 24 or 30 inches. And those tines are each, I'm thinking like 12 or 15 inches long. So you're able to really get down and do some good deep tillage, which helps the roots of the plants to grow downwards, which is going to increase their utilization of the nutrients, you know, rather than going out to the side, really loosening up that soil. So nice. That would be, if I was going with a bare bones setup, that's what I would do. And I'd spend the money on the rototiller. The two-wheeled walking tractor.
Okay. My husband really wants a tractor.
Okay. Four-wheel tractor is great. But it's really hard to get good utilization of your land on a small scale with a four-wheel tractor, you know? And I think up to about 2 acres, the two-wheeled walking tractor makes a lot more sense than getting a four-wheel tractor that you can ride around on. Because that two-wheeled walking tractor, you can turn it around in a very small amount of space. It's really versatile. And what you get for the money you spend is pretty dramatic, you know, and you can buy tools for the back of that that walking tractor. You know, you can buy a flail mower, or you can buy a power harrow, which is like a rototiller, but the tines don't go, they don't tumble forwards, they rotate sideways, so it does a much gentler job of stirring the soil rather than beating it up. You can get those kinds of tools a lot less expensively for a two-wheeled walking tractor than you can for a four-wheeled tractor. So I think, you know, thinking about, it's not just the matter of being able to sit down and ride on the tractor, but you know, how much is the whole package going to cost, and what's the next step going to cost you? You know, not just what I'm buying now, but what am I going to want 2 years from now to improve my management? How much is that going to cost? And can I find a way to get into a system where that's going to be less expensive? Now, of course, if you're going to plan on growing and have 20 acres of organic vegetables, you aren't going to do that with a two-wheeled walking tractor.
No, we have 20 acres total, but a lot of it is trees. But we do have like a little meadow that I think he really wants to plow up. That would be probably like 3 to 5 acres eventually, somewhere down the line.
Yeah, see, and that's going to be four-wheel tractor land.
Very small. I think he has like between a third of an acre to a quarter of an acre. But I don't know. We had water shortage problems last year. I'm hoping we had like some kind of leak and they finally came and fixed it, because we ran out of water a lot last summer. Now, we had a really hot, dry summer here in Montana. And so that was my next question, because like a lot of my guests have talked about the succession thing, and are like, because we're in the Rocky Mountains, like it seems like a lot of our things, like, you know, you put it in the ground the day it goes in, you know, as soon as you can, because you're lucky if you're going to harvest it before you have a frost.
Yeah, in short season climates, that can be really different. But, you know, that's where you might want to look at and say, if I'm going to grow things commercially, I want to look at things that I can reliably do. So I might look, instead of trying to make my living growing tomatoes outside, I might say, hey, I'm going to do salad greens, because I can put salad greens in the ground. I can put a lettuce transplant in a soil block. I can put that in the field on June 1st, and I can be picking that by July 7th. You know, 5 weeks in the field, I'm done. you know, if I plant salad mix, you know, to harvest at the 2 or 3 leaf stage, you're really looking 21 to 24 days for that. So I'd be kind of focusing on those things where you can really turn over crops quickly. Mm-hmm. And things that aren't so frost tender, you know. So I mean, because I think now I don't know where you are in Montana, but I know. I mean, it's kind of funny. You go a lot of places, and the frost free dates are relatively the same over a huge swath of the country. So I farmed out in Maine for a couple of years off the coast of Maine on Mount Desert Island, and we had the same frost free dates there that we have here, May 15th to about September 15th or September 23rd. And you plant tomatoes here on May 15th and you're going to have tomatoes by early August, but you plant tomatoes on the coast of Maine on May 15th and you're still going to be lucky to have outdoor tomatoes to harvest by the time the frost comes around in late September. So very different in terms of the number of degree days that you're getting or how much heat you're getting that goes into growing that plant. Because, of course, you know, plants, the biology is driven by the heat. That's how fast the chemical reactions that grow the leaves are going to go. So, you know, I'd say, you know, thinking about the crops that maybe are going to perform better in the cool weather, you know, become a rutabaga farmer. That's what I do in Montana. I grow a lot of rutabagas. I like rutabagas.
Really?
And radicchio. Yeah. You know, rutabagas and radicchio. I could be really happy out there.
I was going to say, I was listening to your interview with the guys from the Brooklyn Grange today, and you were talking about, and he was talking about not growing broccoli or cabbages or cauliflower as much as the lettuces, because you guys were talking about, you know, where's your production money coming from and what works for you. And so I learned a lot there today listening to you say similar things like that. Our frost date is usually somewhere like the beginning of June, like between the 8th and the 15th, I would think, is our last frost. And then we've had frost as early as the end of August. September, I would say like the first week in September, you're going to have some kind of a frost.
Right. But you know, if you're growing a crop like lettuce or spinach, it doesn't matter when your frost free date is, right?
Yeah. No. You know, and the other thing now, spinach and lettuce, you can, you know, pretty much March, April, you can start putting that in the ground, depending on the year. I mean, last year was crazy. By like the end of February, you could work the soil. But let's hope that was an exception we're never going to see again.
But that's where that succession planning becomes so important. You know, so you're going to put in that spinach on March 15th. You're going to put in another crop of spinach on April 1st, and another crop on April 15th, and just keep on planting. You know. So that's really the big thing in your kind of a setting is to just keep planting with those shorter season crops.
Do you want to tell us what's your least favorite activity to do in the garden or on the farm?
This is going to sound funny for anybody that's listened to my show or been to any of my classes, but you know, my least favorite activity is planting.
Oh, really?
I hate it. I really don't like that work at all. I tend to get stuck down in the weeds. You know, I worry too much about all the details, and it's kind of funny because I'm really big on this idea that you don't do things without planning. You got to plan, but that's not the part that I enjoy. I'd much rather be out there doing, but the doing goes so much better when you've done the planning. But I really don't enjoy that process.
So do you have any basic steps for people to think about when they're planning their garden?
You know, it's really a matter of working backwards. You know, how much of the crop do you want to harvest? How much do you need to plant to be able to harvest that? When do you need to plant it? You know, if you're going to transplant it, how many transplants do you need to be able to do that? It's really just, again, it's that matter of looking out and saying, you know, what do I want to end up with? And then asking, what do I need to do to get there? What are all of the resources and all of the activities that I'm going to need to get to my goal? And then making sure that you've got those resources on hand and that you've got the time and the appropriate number of hands to get the activities done.
That's excellent. And, you know, actually, I did just interview Richard Wiswall. And he's like the first one that said that to me in the right way that really made it sink in. So I think that's an awesome answer. And yeah, a planning has never been like, I'm a total like, go to the store, come home, like, here's some seeds I found, here's some starts I found, where am I going to put it? Standing down there, you know, like shovel, like, I am not a planner, but I'm getting better. This podcast has really taught me a ton. Yeah. What's your favorite activity to do in the garden then? On the flip side, what do you love to get out there and do?
Or napping. I love napping in the garden. I love like laying down on the soil and like, you know, feeling the mycelial creep kind of coming up around you. You know, you can sort of feel the roots coming out of your body and sort of going down in. I love that. I just think that's like the best thing in the world. But the other thing I love is eating. You know, there's nothing. You know, I don't know. I think so many people really miss out on this, and I feel like it's something that I was kind of robbed of in my childhood. But this idea that I can pull something out of the ground, or I can pull something off a plant, and I can put it in my mouth, right? And so you're right there. I mean, this is like the fundamental act of creation, right? You're taking from what has grown in the earth or on the earth, and you're putting that into you and making it part of you. And it's all right there. And it's just, it's so raw. I love that. I love all of the sensations that go on around that. And to be standing in the field and feeling that, you know, it's that same sunshine is beating down on your shoulders that is beating down on that plant and causing everything to happen, you know, and you're just so right there.
That was beautiful. I love that. Yeah, totally. What's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
Give the plants what they need.
I like that.
You know, and this goes back to what I said earlier, right? Plants are made of soil, air, sunshine, and water. And you got to give the plants the soil, the air, the sunshine, and the water that they need. You know, and so if you're going to grow tomatoes, make sure they're growing them in the sun, you know, give them the sunshine, keep the weeds out of the way of anything that you're growing, right? You know, make sure that you've got the nutrients in the soil that those plants need. You know, it's if you look out in nature, not every plant grows everywhere. You know, there are things that your tomato really wants that maybe your lawn didn't need in order to thrive. And so you want to make sure that tomato's got the nutrients that it needs. And, you know, this is the cool thing about organic farming, right? And gardening is that you want to just make sure that it's got enough stuff that it can choose from that cornucopia. This is the great thing about plants, right? They know what they need. I think one of the greatest conceits in the world is this idea of hydroponic gardening, right? We're going to give the plant exactly the nutrients that it wants. How the hell do we know what the plant wants, right? I mean, they decide what they want. You know, there's all kinds of stuff, you know, and there's all the, you know, and we're constantly discovering new things that we didn't know existed in the universe. We don't know what those plants need. So I just think, I mean, feeding those plants lots of organic matter, lots of other nutrients, taking your soil test and making sure that at a minimum you're meeting those requirements in the soil, and then making sure they've got enough water. And I can't emphasize this one enough. If you want to maximize your production, the plants need the water. You gotta put the water on there. Now, there are some arguments. I mean, you know, dry farming tomatoes can make for amazing tasting tomatoes. You know, and I mean, you're up really? In Montana. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. So this was actually popular maybe 10 or 15 years ago out in California. They'd take a tomato and they'd grow it in the greenhouse and they'd make sure it was really leggy. So, you know, you'd end up with like this 18-inch long tomato plant. And then they'd go out with a post hole digger out in the field, and they would have watered and brought the soil up to the right moisture level then, and they would dig down in with this post hole digger 18 inches deep. They'd drop that whole tomato plant down in there. And so just that growing tip was out, and they'd close that in, and then they wouldn't water the tomato, you know? And so the tomatoes that grew on there were super rich and flavorful because they didn't have an abundance of water. And it really made for great tasting tomatoes. But that doesn't work with lettuce. You know, so you gotta think, you know, you kinda gotta balance that out. And the other thing is, if you're growing, you know, in California, you can do that because it's not going to rain. If you rain, you know, if you get a real dry spell and you're growing your tomatoes without any water, and then you get a 2-inch rainfall, all your tomatoes are going to crack. They just absorb the water. I've actually seen whole acres of tomatoes do this when they were under irrigated, and they'll all crack, and that's just a waste. Although not so much in the garden because you can eat them. You know, you can't really sell cracked tomatoes.
Mm-mm. I think I did hear somebody talk about that once, that you're supposed to like stop watering something like 2 weeks before you harvest it.
Well, something like tomatoes I would, but I wouldn't do that with lettuce. You know, I'd keep that lettuce. I'd keep watering that lettuce right up until the day before I was going to harvest it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite recipe that you like to cook from the garden?
Okay. So we're kind of funny in my family. You know, my daughter's favorite vegetable is radicchio.
And do you want to tell listeners what radicchio is if they don't know?
Okay. Radicchio is this glorious red ball of sweetness and bitterness wrapped into one. And it's this bitterness. If you're not familiar with the Italian greens, the chicory family, it's a bitterness that's different. And I get frustrated sometimes by bitter because it doesn't quite describe it. But it happens in a different place in your tongue. It's not a very American flavor. But a lot of people will mistake it for a red cabbage. But it, you know, red cabbages are actually purple cabbages, right? Radicchio is actually bright red. Usually, and it comes in a variety of different forms, but most commonly in kind of a softball sized and softball shaped head. And it can be a little bit tricky to grow. Works best in the fall. I've actually learned, you know, spring radicchio is almost a recipe for disaster, but growing it in the fall, it does fantastic. Very popular in Europe and particularly in Italy. But we'll take that radicchio, and this is absolutely my favorite thing to do out of the garden, is take that radicchio and chop it into about 1-inch squares. So, you know, just, I mean, I say chop it into 1-inch squares, right? I'm just chopping it up, and then put it in a bowl, add a bunch of good olive oil, a little bit of balsamic vinegar, and then salt it really generously, toss it around, and then just let it sit for about an hour in the refrigerator to kind of soak up that olive oil and the vinegar and those other flavors. And then it's just the most fantastic salad. And it's really, I love this salad like at Thanksgiving. One of the cool things you can do with radicchio is it stores really well. I've actually stored radicchio for a couple of months in the cooler after I've harvested it. So, you know, you could grow radicchio, harvest it in mid-September, and still put it on your Thanksgiving plate. And then, you know, it's just such a refreshing contrast to the rich and heavy flavors that oftentimes dominate in what we're eating in November and December.
Awesome. Yep, I grew up eating radicchio. My mom always had that around. Okay, so
now, you know, I'm going to tell you another one. If you want another great recipe for an underutilized vegetable, are these winter radishes. You oftentimes see them advertised as watermelon radishes in the seed catalog. I just think that's the stupidest name ever. I like to call them beauty heart radishes. They're bright pink on the inside and green and white on the outside. You'll see these if you go into like a Whole Foods or your local food co-op. They'll probably have some of these from some weird grower. And it's a storage crop. So in my area here on the 43rd latitude, you know, Decorah, Iowa, Madison, Wisconsin, Mount Desert Island, Maine, all of these places, we'd plant these radishes at like the end of July, and we'd let them grow up. And again, it's a baseball, softball size thing, you know, so thinking like a turnip, okay, but it's got this bright pink interior, and they've got the most, they're slightly bitter in the way that radishes are bitter, so it's different than that radicchio bitter, but they're slightly bitter on the outside, but the inside is sweet. It's a really sweet and crunchy vegetable, and I like to take those and grate them, or if you got a mandolin, you can turn it into a julienne, and then toss that with some sesame oil and some white wine vinegar and some umeboshi plum vinegar. And not too much of that, because, you know, that's just a flavoring thing, and you want to be careful with not overutilizing that. And then just a little bit of salt, maybe a bit of sugar if the radishes aren't as sweet as you'd like them to be. Toss that together, let it sit overnight is best, and then throw it in a colander and let it drain out. And that also makes a fantastic side salad. And you know, what we'll do is we'll make up a huge batch of that, store it in the fridge for a couple of weeks, and I just keep eating off of that, you know, little handfuls of it. So, you know, maybe a half cup, three quarters of a cup almost every day with my lunch or my dinner.
Awesome. What I was going to say during the first part when you're talking about the radicchio is like, so this is kind of something I'm learning with my podcast. Now, you said plant it as a fall crop, but like, when do you put it in the ground? You don't actually put the seeds in the ground in the fall. You put them in the ground in July, like the same with the heart radishes, or?
Yeah. So the radicchio, usually we would plan to have those going into the field in early July, okay. Late June, early July. Oh. And that would give us a harvest, you know, starting at about the beginning of September.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had those watermelon or heart radishes when I was in New York one year. They were at the farmer's market and I love them. Yeah, those are super good. I love that recipe though. That sounds awesome. Something,
you know, there's a lot of really fun things that you can do with raw root crops. You know, if you've got a mandolin, and I love my mandolin. My partner teases me about it because I pull it out and then I refuse to put it away because I start using it for everything. But you can, you know, if you really want to get a sense for what vegetables actually taste like, you know, take those root crops and slice them really thin. You know, I'm thinking a 16th of an inch, even down to like paper thin. And you can do that with the mandolin, and it really brings out some of the delicate flavors. So you do that like with turnips or with rutabagas, and it's a completely different experience than eating, you know, mashed rutabagas with a ton of butter on it. Really. Ooh. Worth doing.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Maybe I'll get my husband to eat them because I don't think he's a big fan of turnip. We don't grow turnips or rutabagas. I think also, like, now see, do they get really buggy? Do you have any tips for, like, it seems like another reason he told me he doesn't grow them is because they're really hard to keep bugs out of.
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of times you'll get especially the flea beetles, you know, the little black jumping beetles that you'll get on the brassicas, you know, so on like your arugulas and your broccolis and your cauliflowers, those will also attack your turnips and your winter radishes and your rutabagas. They can be hard on rutabagas because now we would plant rutabagas about June 15th here, whereas those winter radishes are going in late July. Usually by late July in the upper Midwest, the flea beetles aren't a problem anymore. But they can be hard on the rutabagas. And, you know, if you hit the rutabagas, and, you know, I talked earlier about not going out and just spraying the bejesus out of everything, but a well-timed spray with a product like Pyganic, which is a pyrethrum, you know, made out of these poisonous daisies. And, you spray that just right on the row of the rutabagas. And you don't have to do the whole bed or the whole field, but just right over the row, and it'll knock down those beetles. And if you can give them just a couple of days of protection, the rutabagas will actually jump up and get ahead of those flea beetles.
Okay. All right. How about, do you have all right, wait, before I forget, I skipped the favorite tool question because I thought you gave us all those tools, but then that doesn't necessarily mean that those are your favorite tool. Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what would you take with you?
I'd take my Colonial hoe.
Okay.
That fine bladed hoe that's used for taking care of the weeds when they're really, really small.
Okay, you know what else I should have asked? Because I didn't know what a mandolin was till the summer when my friend Marissa was talking about cooking. So you just want to tell listeners really quick in case they don't know.
Well, so a mandolin is a tool that's used for rapidly creating uniform slices of a product. So if you think about a sheet, you know, maybe like a you know, usually maybe 12 or 16 inches long, and it'll be on an inclined plane. Maybe it's 4 or 5 inches wide, and then in the middle of it, it's got a blade, and you can adjust how high that blade is, and you slide the vegetables over it, and you slice them that way. So you've got the blade is hovering just above the metal, so you get that consistent thickness. Now, you always want to use a guard, you know, use the mandolin the way they sell it to you. Don't use it the way I just described it, so you don't cut the bejesus out of yourself. But that's basically what a mandolin is.
Yeah, cutting herself. She said they're sharp. I remember
they're sharp.
That.
And you're going with a lot of force, you know, and you're moving really fast. So use the guards. Spend the money on a good one.
Okay. How about a favorite internet resource?
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't say, you know, Purple Pitchfork and the Farmer to Farmer podcast. I actually don't tend to turn to the internet for a lot of farming information. I actually end up going to my books mostly, you know, and I'm a pretty connected guy, but I really like my books for actually digging in and getting the information that I need. So I don't really have a favorite internet resource.
Okay. How about a favorite book or reading material then?
Yeah, favorite reading material. Now again, you have to remember I'm coming at this from a farmer perspective. But if you're interested at all in making a living from selling vegetables, or even just making some money from selling vegetables or cut flowers, you got to subscribe to the Growing for Market magazine, which is done. You know, it's a magazine by farmers and for farmers. It's really great. Tons of practical information about how to grow crops, but also about how to manage your business, how to do the marketing. Just an absolutely fantastic resource. Book-wise, I'm really excited about that Market Gardener or Market Farmer book from JM Fortier. I wish I was getting the name on that right. But I also, you know, I think about the ones that guided me through my initial experiences and, you know, where I learned how to do what I do was reading Elliot Coleman's New Organic Grower. I think he's a little impractical talking about 5 acres with a rototiller, but there's a ton of good information in there. And then, I love John Seymour's Self-Sufficient Gardener. I'm not even sure if that's in print anymore. But man, that book, I used to sit in my dorm room at Deep Springs College reading The Self-Sufficient Gardener and just getting excited about the life that I could live.
Awesome. That's so interesting. I just had these people on, this guy, Tony and Denise Gates, from a flower farm, Bear Mountain Farm in Oregon. And well, first of all, they're the first people that told me about you. And I was so excited because I was like, wait, I just booked Chris. He's going to be on next week. And then they also said the same thing about the Growing for Market magazine. And then I just ordered Elliot Coleman's New Organic. It just came in my mailbox today. It's in my, we opened it on the way to school this morning because I hadn't checked my mail yesterday. So cool.
Very, very cool. And I am seeing here, I just went ahead and looked since I'm actually, you know, we're talking over Skype. So,
yeah.
And the new Self-Sufficient Gardener by John Seymour, that's available. You can get it from Amazon. It was published in 2008. So, cool. I just love that book.
Excellent. All right. I'll have to look that up too. Okay. We've been through business advice. Ready for the final question?
Yeah.
Okay, if there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel, Chris, is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Man, I mean, this is just such a no-brainer for me. We need more small-scale organic farmers. And when I say small-scale organic farmers, what I'm talking about is not – I'm not talking about people doing 1 and 2 acres. I'm talking about people thinking, doing 1 or 2 acres, but also, you know, for different crops or for livestock or even for vegetables, you know, 100, 200, 300 acres, you know, but what we need to do is we need more farmers on the land. We need more people in touch with growing their food and out there actually taking care of the land. I talked about my environmental ethos and kind of how I came into agriculture from that perspective. You know, if you want to change the world, you change how we eat, because land, that's what land's used for. More land in the United States is used for farmland than any other purpose. And so if you farm or ranch land, if you change how we're managing that, then you're changing the planet. And really, you can't make that change from an office, you know, and I feel a little bit awkward saying that. I'm not farming now. I'm a consultant and I do a podcast and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But we need people on the ground and we need people succeeding at farming, you know, and so more small scale organic farmers. And really what that's going to come down to is more people willing to pay for the food that they eat. Put your money where your mouth is. You know, if you care about the environment, you should be eating organic produce and organic food, and preferably local organic food.
That's not easy to do, though.
No, it's not. But who said saving the world was going to be easy?
Okay.
I don't do easy. I hate easy. You know, there's too many people out there selling easy. It ain't easy. It's hard. It's hard work. You know, and it sucks to think about everything that you do all the time. And I certainly have my, I don't want to come off as a purist. I have my places that I compromise. I have food that I buy that isn't organic because, you know, there's only a limited number of dollars in my wallet. And, you know, but making those choices when you can make those choices, you can't. Like I said earlier, you know, if you want to be in, you know, if you want to succeed at farming, you have to be good at growing, but you also have to make money because that's how you buy the seeds so you can farm next year and how you pay to stay on the land and you pay your taxes and you make sure your kids can go to college. And if we can't have farmers be able to do that, we're not going to have farmers. And that's what we got going on in this country. I mean, I don't know if your listeners are aware, but average age of farmers in this country, I think is somewhere now north of 60. Okay. Oh. Just think about that for a minute. What's going to happen? That's the average age of farmers in this country, right? That means there's a lot of 70 and 80 year old farmers because there's a lot of 40 year old farmers. You know, we're aging our population out of this very important, very fundamental occupation that where we actually are in touch with the earth. You know, we're making a difference out there. And I don't think people realize this. I mean, you know, farmers provide tremendous ecological services. And really one of the big disasters that we've got going on now, as we have more land that is occupied by tenants instead of by farmer owners, we're losing the connection to those pieces of land that prompt the farmers to do those ecological services. You know, to provide the drainage. I mean, the reason that we have flood problems in the Midwest is because we no longer have the ability to absorb water that falls on our farmland because the soil is crap. You know, if you've got organic farms, if you've got people raising grass-fed beef on healthy pastures, you dramatically increase the ability of that soil to hold that water. You know, you keep nitrates from leaching into the groundwater. You know how much money the city of Des Moines spends on water treatment because of the crap that farmers are putting on their land?
No. Okay?
It's tremendous amounts. There's actually the lawsuits over this. Now, the city of Des Moines is suing, I think, the state of Iowa. Don't quote me on that. I might be wrong about who's suing who. But they're actually trying to get recouped because they're feeling like the city, the water, right? I mean, Plants, people are made of water and grass. I mean, that's what we are. And the water's polluted. You know, it's undrinkable now because of the crap way that people are managing farmland. And that's not going to change. That's not going to change in a cheap food economy. And it's not going to change unless we start getting more organic, sustainable, small farmers, people who care and are willing to spend the time out on the land, get off the tractor seat and go be in the land, be on the land, be a part of it.
Very nice.
Sorry, that was my rant.
I like it. I think listeners will too. Do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden different than the one you just gave us?
Dude, I'm gonna riff off of the one that I just gave you, which comes from my good friend Carl Hammer, who is a compost maker extraordinaire out at Vermont Compost Company. And I'm required now to say, I guess FCC says that when I mention Vermont Compost Company, I have to mention they give me money for my podcast. But I've worked with Carl for years and years, long before he was a sponsor of my podcast. Like you say, this guy is a compost master. And you know, compost and soil, you know, is held together. When you look at a piece of soil and it's got the little bubbles in it, you know, where the earthworms have been, and you can kind of see how it's all glued together. That's what we call soil structure, right? And the thing that holds it together, it's a substance called glomalin. And that's what makes the soil, the individual clay particles that are too small for your eye to see, that's what makes them stick together into something that we would actually call soil. And Carl says, you know, glomalin is the glue that holds the world together. I really like that. You know, that's what you're doing when you're farming, right? When you're gardening, you're out there with the soil. You're interacting with that. You're participating in the glue that holds the world together.
Nice. And I would totally encourage listeners to check out the Verant. Like, can they ship it anywhere? It sounded like when I was listening to your show today, did they ship it anywhere?
Yeah, they do. Now,
coming up with good compost is like a hard thing to do. I know, like, we're always looking for good places to get good soil and stuff.
Yeah, Vermont Compost Company. I mean, their specialty is potting soils. You know, that's the big thing that they would be shipping, and they do ship that around the country now. But if you're looking for compost, you probably it's going to be hard for that to pay to actually get the compost. You know, from Vermont out to a place like Montana.
Yeah, but getting good potting soil here. Like, good potting soil. I bought 4 bags of potting soil that are still sitting on my gazebo last year. That my husband's like, we're not putting that anywhere, and it said organic right on the bag that I bought at one of the big box stores. Now, surprisingly enough, the best organic potting soil I found was at my local hardware store.
So let's talk just real quickly about something that's labeled as organic, right? The only labeling regulations in this country for using the word organic are around food. Okay? Food and fiber. So if you're buying something that says this is organic potting soil, that's completely unregulated. Doesn't mean anything. So, okay. You know, just be aware of that. I mean, check the ingredients and go with companies you feel good about. If you're a commercial grower and you're doing or maybe even a large gardener, you know, check with the other farmers in the area. You know, can you put together a truckload? You know, can you put together part of a truckload that's going, you know, further, maybe something that's going further west, or maybe you guys are the last stop on a string that's going through, you know, South Dakota and North Dakota on out to Montana. You know, maybe there's a way to kind of to catch on to some of that if you're doing stuff on a larger scale. I think you can order Vermont compost potting soil from a Gardner's Supply Company.
Oh.
Too. So, okay. I'm not 100% positive about that. We should look, but, yeah, you know, look around. I mean, that stuff might be available, and it's not impossible to find good potting soil. And most parts of the country have somebody that's doing a good job with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to tell listeners how to connect with you?
So the best way to connect with me, and if you're already listening to a podcast, I'd encourage you to go over and have a listen to the Farmer to Farmer podcast. I think most people who are gardening, I think, are going to enjoy at least hearing how things are different on the farm. So I check that out, and that's, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever podcast, what do we call them in the industry, right? They're pod servers or something like that. You know, whatever way you're used to listening to podcasts, check out the website. You can also listen to it on the website at farmertofarmerpodcast.com. You can also see some of the other work that I'm doing at purplepitchfork.com, which is where I keep all of my educational and consulting information.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being such an awesome guest today. I know listeners are going to love this episode. This was just full of golden nuggets, as John would say, and just tons of, you know, just valuable information. I know I learned a ton, so I'm sure the listeners did too.
Great. Thank you so much, Jackie, for having me. This was a lot of fun to be on the other side of the microphone for a change.
Oh, cool. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to